Today's sermon is entitled The Image Imprinted on Your Heart. It's taken from Exodus 33, verses 12 through 23. That's the Moses and God speaking to each other. And from Matthew 22, 15 through 22. The image printed on your heart. If you had the choice between 10 ounces of gold or 10 ounces of water, which would you prefer? Think about that question for a minute and make no assumptions. Don't assume that when you turn the handle on the faucet that anything's going to come out of it. And don't assume that many of the businesses that are buying and selling gold are going to be open for business. So which would you choose, gold or water? Of course, we know that the answer is relative. It really depends upon the situation. If you're starving of thirst and there's no water available, you would probably trade 100 ounces of gold for a single ounce of water. And that's the kind of question and dilemma that confronted Moses in our Old Testament lesson, and it confronted Jesus in our gospel reading, and it confronts you or I in our daily walk with God. Which do you prefer, gold or water? In today's Old Testament reading, we have this conversation going on between God and Moses. It occurs just after Moses crashes the party of the golden calf, when all the Israelites had abandoned the true God, and they were looking for perhaps a more tameable God, a more tangible God. Golden calf, after all, it doesn't tell you where to go, and it doesn't lead you to the brink of starvation or dehydration, as Moses' God had done. A golden calf is shiny and luxuriant and make you feel rich. And Moses spoils this party, and God punishes the people for their faithless behavior. And God seems to have really had it now with the Israelites. And he tells Moses, I'm going to send an angel with you and the Israelites to lead you into the land that I told you about, but I'm no longer going with you. My presence is not going with you. And that might have seemed like a reasonable arrangement. I mean, the land that God had promised them was supposed to be rich, flowing with milk and honey that's the color of gold, and wasn't that the goal, after all? The land. Moses sees the seriousness of this problem, and with the problem with this arrangement, he speaks boldly to God and says, look, you said that I found favor in your sight, but now you say that you won't come with me? How will anyone know that these people are your people unless you come with us? Moses seems to understand what's at stake here. What mattered was not the rich land that they were to acquire, but the richness of God's presence with them, which is more valuable than gold. Wants and needs. Another way of stating this is, which is more important, what we want or what we need? The most sought after elements in the world might be gold, but if you're dehydrated, you have to have water. Just as you're gasping for breath, you need oxygen, and all the gold in the world won't satisfy your thirsts and won't prevent you from suffocating. We spend a lot of time and energy in pursuit of our wants. We want good food. We want cars. We want a nice home. We want a nice neighborhood. We want entertainment. We want vacations. And the only reason we can spend so much time and energy pursuing these nice things is that our basic needs are well taken care of. So well taken care of that we forget to recognize who takes care of those needs. Ultimately, we have to recognize our Creator as the one who brings us life and the elements essential for maintaining life. Moses recognized this supply chain. If you alienate yourself from your supplier, your supplies will run out. If you separate yourself from the one who gives you life, your life is eventually extinguished. There were probably many Israelites out there in the desert who would have been quite content going ahead into the promised land without the presence of God. Moses recognized the peril of such a move, and he persuaded God not to withdraw his presence. But then Moses asks for something that God could not provide him. With a good dose of chutzpah, Moses asks to see God's face. Now, this is an interesting request because Moses had seen plenty of evidence of God's presence. He had seen the burning bush. He and the people had seen the pillar of smoke by day and the fire by night. They had seen water flow from a rock. They had seen food fall from the sky. But it wasn't enough. Moses thought that seeing God's face would satisfy him, and a loving God answered that he could not see God's face and live. And here is a good place to draw the line of connection between our Old Testament lesson and our gospel reading, because central to Jesus' lesson is the image of the face of Caesar on a Roman coin. Caesar, who declared himself Savior and Son of God. Such audacity is not unique to Rome. Throughout history, there were many kings and emperors and dictators who thought themselves to be divine and demanded that the people treat them as such. And such people spend a lot of time posing for photographs, posing for paintings, posing for sculptures. We imagine kings and queens sitting on thrones, regal and stationary, and this reflects the relationship that they have with their subjects. A king or queen spends a lot of time sitting and posing while their subjects are expected to work for them. These living gods are as passive as the craven images that people cast and represent, cast of them that represent their other gods. But our God reverses this relationship. Our God is a God who is active. He's seen not simply as a bush, but a burning bush, a whirlwind of smoke and a whirlwind of fire, moving ahead of the people, leading them toward a goal. This is a God who's active in serving his people, feeding them, bringing them water. And in Jesus, we see the same relationship manifest. Jesus is active. He heals the sick. He releases the captives. He feeds the hungry. He teaches his followers. Our God is too busy to be cast into craven images. Even Jesus is described in prophecy as having no form or majesty that we should look upon him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. And after the resurrection, a lot of folks don't recognize who he is. Our God seems to avoid being cast into any image because, quite frankly, he's too busy to allow us to cast him in that image. In fact, I think that God is more of a verb than a noun. God is too busy doing to bother being. It is our hearts and minds that seem to settle on what is stationary, what is lifeless. We are all too prone to settle upon the gifts more than the giver, the promised land rather than the one who leads us there, the mighty dollar that has no life of its own and buys those things that have no life of their own. We are the ones who look for the hard, lifeless gold rather than the fluid, life-giving water of God. And we forget that God is the acting principle which makes it possible for us to even get distracted and to start pursuing lifeless idols. It's this idolatry issue that Jesus is confronting in today's gospel lesson, and he uses the coin called a denarius to illustrate his point. The Pharisees and the Herodians, who consider Jesus more than a nuisance, ask him publicly if the Jewish people should pay taxes. Now, it's a trap. If Jesus answered yes, he would have discredited himself with the crowd that hardly owned a denarius because they were on the verge of starvation. And they would have dropped Jesus like a hot potato if he implied that they should pay taxes to Caesar, who was fleecing them beyond belief. Of course, if Jesus had said no, his enemies would have put a bug in Pilate's ear, and Jesus would have been arrested faster than you could say Jack Robinson. So what was he to do? Well, some might say that Jesus was rather crafty and avoided this no-win situation with the often quoted response, give to Caesar what is Caesar and give to God what is God's. But I don't think Jesus was really trying to avoid anything or really trying to be crafty. He certainly understood the motives of his enemies and he referred to them as hypocrites. But he sees, see what he says, after that. He says, show me a coin used for tax. And notice that Jesus did not reach into his pocket and pull out a coin. Jesus didn't have a coin to pull out, nor did his disciples. Most of them, like I say, were on the brink of starvation. These folks were dirt poor and likely had never even seen a denarius. It was because that was worth quite a bit. And whether intentional or not, Jesus' request to see the coin put his inquisitors on the spot because they managed to produce a denarius in the temple where there was not supposed to be any Roman coinage. And the Pharisees in particular would have advocated such a policy of keeping Roman coins out of there. But these particular Pharisees got him a denarius right there in the temple. So their response to Jesus' request serves to discredit his critics in the eyes of those who could see. It exposed them as the hypocrites that they were, telling the people to do one thing while they themselves did the opposite. But Jesus goes further. Whose image and whose title is there? Whose image? Does that ring some bell with you? Perhaps the first chapter of Genesis, and in his image, God created us, man and woman. Does it conjure up the commandment, thou shalt have no graven images before me? They are in the temple with a forbidden coin, and on it is a forbidden image. And the one who produces the coin are the Pharisees and the Herodians. Can't get much more hypocritical than that, can you? Now, in response to Jesus' question, whose image, the Pharisees answer, Caesar's. Right, Caesar's, who demanded the worship, to be worshipped as a god. And just to add a little insult to injury, Jesus ends this little exchange by saying, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, give back to God what is God. When Jesus prompts us to give to Caesar what is Caesar and to God what is God, he's not saying that there's a clear division between church and state. How much are we supposed to give God? 50%, 60%, more, less? How can we possibly answer anything less than 100%? God, our creator, redeemer, sustainer, we who are created in his image and who receive everything we have, the air that we breathe, the food that we eat, the fellowship we enjoy, did we receive it all from God? Yes, of course. So does God not deserve everything we have? Is not everything we claim to own actually his? Is not everything that brings us joy actually his own doing? The sun that rises, the warmth of the earth, the birds that sing, the morning light, and the one who sleeps beside us and welcomes us with a good morning and sausage and eggs, and were they not provided by our Creator? The beauty of music and of the meadows and of New York Harbor and the Outer Bridge Crossing at night and the delicious food that we eat, was this not God's own doing? So to whom do we owe everything? Our life, our whole life, is about receiving from God and giving back to God. We're like the Israelites in that we are tempted to focus on the gifts and forget about the giver. We may be tempted to worship our own image rather than the image of God, or rather than the God who needs no image. We serve ourselves rather than the poor, the afflicted, the downtrodden, and those who most resemble our Savior. I know that many of you know this already, that the full life, the joyful life, the rich and exciting life is found when we give our lives to Christ and to one another. That's what Jimmy Stewart showed us in It's a Wonderful Life. Give until you have nothing left to give, and guess what? The house may be drafty, the menu may be just ground beef instead of New York strip, and your vacation may be spent in a public park rather than a private resort, but when you give to others, when you give to God, you get so much more in return, because it is there that you gain the assurance that God's presence goes with you. And though you may never reach that penthouse on the Upper West Side, you know that someday you will reach the promised land.